One of the keys to understanding Nietzsche is to understand that he's both a philosopher and a psychologist. In fact, he says at one point he's the first philosopher to be a great psychologist. This, I think, is absurd. One can trace the connection between philosophy and psychology all the way back to the Greeks. Certainly the medieval Christians were philosophers who were almost obsessed with human psychology. And in the modern period, we have people like John Locke, and just before Nietzsche, of course, there's Schopenhauer. Nevertheless, I think the connection is an important one, and it's particularly striking if we think in historical terms, because until the 20th century, really, the distinction between philosophy and psychology was not at all defined. I often joke that it's really academic administrations and probably warring faculty members that push the two subjects apart from one another. I think the truth is that every great philosopher has also been a psychologist, but I think Nietzsche does deserve some credit as being perhaps the most insightful and the most profound of all of them. He synthesized philosophy and psychology in a number of different ways. One might say that what he gave us was a psychoanalysis of morals, a psychoanalysis of religion, and in this he anticipates, most obviously, Freud and some of the psychoanalysts who came after Freud. But I think a very clear way of putting this without falling into any kind of psychoanalytic jargon is to say that the way Nietzsche thought of his own thinking is that it had to be strictly naturalistic. Now, what that means on the one hand is that it's natural as opposed to supernatural, that explanations had to be in human terms, or at least biological, earthly terms, rather than theological terms. If you want to talk about morality, then don't talk about its divine origins, but rather talk about the human motivations that underlie it. Or to put it in a different way, what Nietzsche wants to do is to explain morality. Most philosophers, by contrast, have tried to justify it. Immanuel Kant, for example, one of the very great philosophers of the modern period, and probably pretty arguably the greatest German philosopher before Nietzsche, had a thesis which essentially said that morality is a matter of reason. And reason, of course, is something that was put in us by God. But also, Kant tried to justify morality. In fact, a good third of his great philosophy is devoted to just that, to understand exactly why morality is necessary for rational beings. What Nietzsche wants to do, by contrast, is to explain why not such rational beings as ourselves would be moved to accept morality, or to put it more precisely in ways that we'll explain later, why they would be inclined to accept a set of rules which were quite distinctively to their own immediate individual disadvantage. So what we're going to be looking for Nietzsche, is a way of understanding morality, a way of understanding religious belief, in psychological terms. A few examples. One can think, for example, of the idea that we are naturally inclined to be kind. They were naturally inclined to be compassionate, something that a great many philosophers have argued and hoped for. The ancient philosopher Mencius in China argued such a thesis. The economist Adam Smith, who was also a great moral philosopher, argued such a thesis. And more immediately, Schopenhauer, Nietzsche's mentor, had argued such a thesis. What Nietzsche points out is, if you really examine pity, compassion, sympathy, and the like, what you find is something very different. What you find, among other things, is a search for individual superiority, an assertion of individual power, if it's nevertheless a kind of impotent and pretty pathetic power. But when you are compassionate towards someone, when you have pity for someone, there's a sense in which what you're doing is making yourself a superior. Or if you're kind to someone, if you exercise the virtue called benevolence, the truth is what you're doing is asserting and reinforcing a certain amount of power you have over that person. If nothing else, the power to be able to give them something. But of course, the same is true on the negative side. If you are cruel to someone, what follows is that you are asserting your power. Again, in a petty, perhaps reprehensible way. But cruelty and benevolence both are, in effect, exercises of power. And the idea of personal power, asserting one's strength, is something that pervades Nietzsche's psychology. In fact, it is its primary principle. This gives rise to an obvious contrast. One of the philosophies that was most prevalent in Nietzsche's time, in fact, it's still prevalent today, was the mainly English philosophy called utilitarianism. The idea that what people are motivated by is pleasure or the avoidance of pain. What people really want is happiness. And the way to understand their behavior is by that, to understand how certain courses of action, perhaps long-term courses of action, make for more pleasure, for less pain, for more happiness. Nietzsche says, rather strikingly, that actually this is a very poor explanation of most human behavior. Human beings often do what will make them unhappy. For example, they act out of spite. They act out of resentment. They act out of envy. And these things don't make anyone happier, but what they all do, in one way or another, sometimes very deviously, is they assert a person's power. Nietzsche's attitude towards utilitarianism is, like most German philosophers of the time, largely dismissive. He finds it vulgar. He says, in what I think is one of his best lines, man does not want pleasure, only the Englishman does. Actually, I still didn't get it right. Should I repeat the whole thing? Yes. One of Nietzsche's best lines, in my view, is when he says, man does not seek happiness, only the Englishman does. It's a kind of direct attack on Nietzsche's nemesis, although one sometimes wonders why, John Stuart Mill, who was probably the greatest English philosopher of the late 19th century, and in a way, Nietzsche's direct competitor. But the competition really was between two different theories, a theory of power, a theory of pleasure. The one theory said that people are basically motivated by hedonism, the desire for happiness. The other says that a good deal of human behavior, if not all of human behavior, and by the way, animal behavior too, can much better be explained as the pursuit of some sort of power, self-expression, assertion. Nietzsche considers, for example, people who defended what we would today call animal rights. And Nietzsche himself was certainly not cruel, and in particular had a certain kind of affection for animals, as I mentioned in the first lecture. When he collapsed on the street of Italy, he was hugging a horse to prevent it from a beating. Nevertheless, looking very skeptically at animal rights advocates, what he suggests, and I'm sure we can all think of examples, is that people who are so gung-ho about animal rights are really betraying a kind of hatred of their fellow human beings. That what they're doing is displacing what looks like love. In fact, is something very much like hatred. He also says that of morality in general, we think of people being moral because they're obeying the rules, or because they're being reasonable, or simply because they are going along with what everyone else thinks they ought to do. But what Nietzsche points out is that what really drives us to behave morally is our enormous fear of solitude, of being shunned, of being left alone. And once again, if you examine your own motives in doing the right thing, in at least some occasions, what you realize is that the dominant motivation, we're not talking about justification, the dominant motivation, the dominant explanation, is the fact that we're afraid we'll lose our friends. People won't talk to us. In Tom Wolfe's new book, A Man in Full, the lead character at the very end has to make what amounts to the decision of his life. And the primary motive that clearly drives him is he's afraid of taking one stand because he'll lose his friends, the people who now talk to him, the people who now go hunting and fishing and are his buddies, will no longer respect him. Nietzsche wants to say, solitude is a very important aspect of human life. solitude, more importantly, is a very important element in integrity, and the extent to which we're willing to lose our friends, to be shunned, is just that kind of motivation we need to be able to tell the truth. And Nietzsche's philosophy, which often turns out to be harsh and polemical, to say things that other people won't say, has to be understood in part in terms of rejection of that sense that being shunned, being ignored, is the worst thing that can happen to us. That's not to say that Nietzsche didn't want to be read and that he didn't resent, as his career unfolded, the fact that his books were not being bought. But nevertheless, to understand Nietzsche is to understand just how important that emphasis on peer pressure, that emphasis on social solidarity, must have been first to him, but secondly, how much he saw that that is the dominant motive of so much of our behavior. Nietzsche uses this psychological, philosophical kind of mix to understand morality in general and understand the work of particular philosophers. For example, trying to understand Schopenhauer and Schopenhauer's pessimism in particular, one can easily understand why Nietzsche would be almost obsessed with the question, why would a person defend a philosophy which basically says life is no good? What must it be about the philosopher that promotes that view? And trying to understand that very clearly is a form of psychoanalysis. Perhaps it comes through most clearly in Nietzsche's most frequent target, also, in a sense, his most frequent hero, and that's in his diagnosis of Socrates. We already mentioned that Nietzsche says, rather outrageously, that Socrates was ugly. But that, of course, is one piece of a larger picture. Socrates hates life. Now, that's not the way we usually think of Socrates. In Plato's dialogues, Socrates is usually buoyant, almost buffoonish. He's a man about town. He's the gadfly. He's the person who wants to talk to everyone and seems to be enjoying his life immensely. And yet Nietzsche looks very skeptically and critically at the philosophy, which says, among other things, that the way we should view ourselves is not in terms of this earthly social body, but rather the way we should view ourselves is in terms of this eternal soul, something which clearly is going to carve the way for Christianity. And what's more, we should think of the real world, not in terms of this changing world that we live in which things are born and grow and decay and die, but rather we should think of the real world as a perfect world, a world in which only perfect ideals exist, of which this world is really only a shadow. And Nietzsche asked the question, what would make a philosopher think in such terms? And here the diagnosis comes home. Socrates hated life. However happy, joyful, sociable he may have seemed, the truth is Socrates was looking for another world. And you can anticipate what his primary objective in attacking Christianity is going to be. That basically Christianity rejects this world with all of its sufferings, with death, and replaces it with a fantasy that there is no death, a fantasy of a world in which there is no change, in which people don't suffer, in which all this that we're going through now will somehow be eclipsed and perhaps forgotten. That is a rationalization. And again, it's a kind of explanation. Nietzsche doesn't try and justify morality. He just wants to explain it. There's another sense in which Nietzsche diagnoses Christianity and Christian morality in particular as a kind of a slave morality. I've mentioned this, and I'm going to be talking about it in great detail later on, but just to anticipate in the same vein, what Nietzsche wants to do is ask the question, why would people accept what they call morality? And of course, one piece of it is what I already said, and that is that people are afraid of being shunned. They're afraid of being pushed aside and ignored, of being left alone. And in that sense, Nietzsche points out that what we call morality is really a herd morality, What we really want is to remain like everyone else, or at least be liked by everyone else. There's a deeper sense, though, in which if you think of the particular values of Christianity, such notions as humility and meekness, what David Hume, an earlier philosopher, had referred to as the monkish virtues, what one starts to suspect is that while these present themselves as virtues of strength, the truth is they're virtues of weakness. And so the diagnosis here is that Christian morality, in general, should be understood in psychological terms. And those psychological terms are largely going to be diagnostic in terms of human foibles, in terms of human weaknesses, in terms of what Nietzsche generally calls the human all too human. Now, let me say that this isn't entirely dismissive, because the other side of this is to appreciate what is done out of strength, what Nietzsche refers to in many of his works as the noble way of living. And he wants to understand that psychology too. There's a sense in which he very clearly anticipates modern psychology, not just Freud, whom I'll come back to in a moment, but also some other figures who are very important and, in fact, anticipate Nietzsche in some important ways. The first to be mentioned here is a Danish philosopher who will come up again. Kathy mentioned him in the last lecture. His name is Søren Kierkegaard. He was a philosopher in the middle of the 19th century, so just before Nietzsche by a few decades. It's pretty clear that Nietzsche did not have a chance to read him, although he may have heard of him. Kierkegaard, unlike Nietzsche, was a devoutly religious philosopher, but in some very interesting ways, they agreed. And in fact, they're both often classified as existentialists, something which I'll draw on a question later on. But the basic idea, which was really created by another German psychologist in the 20th century named Karl Jaspers, was that for all of their obvious disagreements, Kierkegaard being a devout Christian, Nietzsche being a rather rampant atheist, for all their apparent disagreements, they really were much more in agreement than not. For example, in their attitude towards what they both called, but Kierkegaard in particular called, Christendom, or less flatteringly still, the Christian mob, the idea of Christianity as a herd religion. Kathy mentioned in the last lecture the fact that what Nietzsche really despised about Christianity was much more the kind of social institutions. And in particular, what he wanted to say was that Christianity as we know it, and Kierkegaard said much the same thing, Christianity as we know it is really more of a social institution, almost like a club, somewhat exclusive club, and it's meant more for the mutual self-righteousness and aggrandizement of its members than it is, as it states, for a kind of appreciation of something divine, spiritual, and so on. Kierkegaard, too, is a profound depth psychologist. He analyzes the motives behind most people and their kind of hypocritical Christianity in terms of human weaknesses like laxity, laziness, and, of course, hypocrisy itself can be a powerful motive. Nietzsche follows him, and I think in many ways they agree that what Christianity does and the way Christianity must be understood is largely in terms of social peer pressure and not in terms of any particular kind of theological or even psychological motive for spirituality. Kierkegaard, of course, attacks this by way of recreating a genuine notion of Christianity. Nietzsche attacks it in order to put down Christianity for certain purposes. But nevertheless, I think the two should be seen as akin, and I think the two should be seen as two of the great psychologists behind morality and religion in the modern period. The other figure that comes to mind here is the Russian novelist Fyodor Dostoevsky. Dostoevsky, with Kierkegaard, both had a profound insight into the nature of despair, or the emotion that these days is generally referred to in the German style as angst, anguish, anxiety. Kierkegaard, for example, wrote an entire book, his first book, on the concept of dread. Dostoevsky, in such novels as The Brothers Karamazov in particular, characterizes the same kind of depth psychology and talks about the intense fear, the anxiety of the possibility of facing life without God. Brother Ivan Karamazov essentially says in a famous line, which is often attributed to Nietzsche, if there is no God, everything is permitted. But in Ivan's mouth, this is certainly not a kind of joyous cheerfulness, as it will be for Nietzsche in a sense, but rather, it's a cry of despair. And not surprisingly, Ivan goes crazy by the end of the novel. Both Dostoevsky and Kierkegaard were keenly aware of the role of fear and anxiety in human life, and Nietzsche reinforces this. He talks about the fear of solitude. He talks about the fear of human nature itself, of the passions, of the forces within us which we don't really understand. And here, of course, he anticipates two of the greatest thinkers in this tradition, one a contemporary, namely Karl Marx, and the other, immediately following him, Sigmund Freud. I'll talk about Marx first because it's a much simpler conversation. It might seem a little bit mysterious that Marx and Nietzsche are put together in the same breath. In fact, Nietzsche hated socialism. He despised democracy. And Marx, in an obvious way, was sensitive and in favor of them both. But they agreed in something else, which was more fundamental. And in this, they could trace their origins to an earlier German philosopher, the beginning of the 19th century, a man named Ludwig Feuerbach, who followed such idealists as Hegel and Kant, who argued that the world consisted mainly of ideas, and what was primarily real was the human mind. And what they replaced it with, what Feuerbach replaced it with, was a conception that what the world is basically is matter. And what human beings are, basically, is matter in motion. If you want to understand human beings, don't ask first, what do they believe? If you want to understand a human being, ask first, what does he eat? Feuerbach defends a notorious pun in German, man ist, was man ist. And what that means basically is one is what one eats. It's a defense of a basic kind of materialism, not crude materialism in the sense that we sometimes use that term today, namely somebody who worries only about material goods, cars, sofas, stereos, and the like. But rather, it's materialism in a basic philosophical sense, that the world is straightforwardly matter. The world can be understood in terms of physics and biology. It is perfectly of a piece with Nietzsche's emphasis on naturalism, which in this interpretation means very straightforwardly. If you want to understand human behavior, if you want to understand human motivation, then look to biology, look to physics, look to the kind of energies, look to the kind of motivations, the instincts that biology gives us. And that's where you'll understand why people are the way they are. Feuerbach came crashing into Germany and caused immediate scandals. He had some very important followers, one of whom, of course, was Karl Marx. Marx was also a materialist. He talked about himself as standing Hegel on his head. And what he meant by that was Hegel had talked about the world in terms of ideas. What came first and foremost were the material circumstances of a person's life. And so Marx then essentially becomes an economist. He was, early on, a Romantic philosopher. But in his mature years, and as we know him, Marx becomes an economist, and what he starts talking about are the material conditions of life, the forces of production, how economics sort of sets the basis upon which everything else, religion, philosophy, culture, art, all are based. Which brings us to Freud. Freud was also a materialist in this sense. One of his first writings, a work that he never actually published, but was certainly published fairly soon after, was a scientific project for making a materialist psychology. The very word psychology comes from the study of the psyche, the study of the mind. Freud, of course, kept that, but one of his first projects was a kind of equation between the mind and the brain. Now, without going into much detail here, one can say that at the end of the 19th century, one of the things that was happening was the discovery of neurology. And with the discovery of neurology in its modern sense came the possibility of understanding not just human behavior in its more obvious physical aspects, but human behavior in terms of its most intellectual productions, understanding it all in terms of biology. And this is something that Nietzsche clearly endorsed, and Freud, in fact, admits that he picked up a good many of his ideas from Nietzsche. In fact, he even says he stopped reading at a certain point. He stopped reading Nietzsche at a certain point because he realized that if he kept reading, he would find nothing original to say. But the idea is that what they shared in common, the reason why Nietzsche is so important for understanding modern psychology, is that he did have, as Marx had, a kind of deep skeptical attitude towards people's stated motivations. Rationalization, intellectualization, just played too profound a role. That there are certain ways we would like to think of ourselves. There are certain motives that we would like to think move us. When in fact, this is just a cover story. That when, for example, what we feel is compassion, and of course we would like to think of ourselves as compassionate creatures, if you look more closely, what you often find is that instead of compassion, it's different modes of selfishness, different modes of exerting your superiority or your power. If you defend a cause, it might be a very moral cause. You might have a perfectly good justification for it. But if you look for the motivation behind your behavior, what you will often see is something very different. This is sometimes called, rather, I think, pretentiously, the hermeneutics of suspicion. But it's something that Marx excelled in. It's something that Freud would excel in. But the main figure here has to be Nietzsche. What it means is, don't accept people's stated motivation at face value. People are not, as earlier philosophers had sometimes argued, in a privileged position. In fact, even in an unmistakable position to understand why they do the things they do, to put it in terms that Freud would use, motivation is often unconscious. It is least accessible to the person who is actually doing the deed. And it sometimes takes enormous effort, certainly on the part of that person himself or herself, to understand what it is that's making them do what they do. From a third-person point of view, of course, you don't get the same kind of resistance. Nevertheless, if what you're trying to understand is human motivation in general, because we are inevitably talking about ourselves as a member of the species, that same resistance sets in, which is why the philosophers of the 18th century in particular were so fond about talking about the natural compassion, the natural sympathy that motivated us all, about the natural fellow feeling, sort of community sensibility that motivated human behavior. But as Nietzsche is quick to point out, what is called community sensibility might also be called herd mentality, the fear of being alone, the desperate fear of solitude. In the same way, when people talk about themselves as loving, well, it's not that Nietzsche attacks love. Certainly he himself fell in love a couple of times, and there's a sense in which he could be a loving person more generally, and more philosophically. He certainly saw certain kinds of love which were highly virtuous, very noble. But what is often called love is something that, like pity or compassion, is deep down petty, selfish, a kind of possessiveness. He says, for example, if you think about romantic love, sexual love, what could be more possessive than that? And we talk about being completely selfless. The truth is, there is nothing more selfish than love. So, anticipating Freud, Nietzsche wants to say, philosophers must be psychologists. They must try to explain human behavior, including one's own human behavior, and one has to try to not give a whitewash rationalization, but instead try to understand what's really going on. And that question, what's really going on, is precisely what we're going to be talking about for the next several lectures. Thank you.